This is Charlotte Tux. I'm Mike Collins. Dinosaurs. They're long gone today, but in their time, these creatures, many of whom are quite large, ruled the world, and their influence is still being felt today. I mean, just think fossil fuels. Don Lessem is an expert on dinosaurs. He's excavated them, written about them, acted as a consultant on the first Jurassic Park movie. Genghis Khan. He's long gone today, but he was a larger-than-life man who conquered and ruled much of Eurasia over 700 years ago. And like the dinosaurs, his influence is still being felt today in that part of the world. Don Lessem is also an expert on Genghis Khan and the creator and curator of Genghis Khan, Bring the Legend to Life exhibit at Discovery Place. But how did that happen and why? We spoke with Don Lessem in January, and we're going to listen back to that conversation this hour. He joined us from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia.
Thanks, Mike.
You have been interested, drawn to, in fact, dinosaurs since you were five. Lots of kids are drawn to dinosaurs, and you even tried, I'm told, to pursue other interests like a serious journalism career at the Boston Globe, only to be pulled back in toward dinosaurs. What finally diverted your attention and your interest to Genghis Khan?
I thought you were going to say tried and failed.
I didn't. Well, actually, did you?
Depends who you ask, I think. It's the fault of the Boston Globe, actually. I got away from dinosaurs like most kids do when I got to be 8 or 9 and in favor of sports and girls, and I'm still all in favor of sports and girls.
Mm-hmm.
But the Globe sent me on a story in the days when newspapers had money to see two dinosaur researchers. And when I got out there, I thought, oh my gosh, this science is fascinating, and it's not like brain surgery, it's quite accessible. And I just got interested in the whole aspect of it, not just the animals, but the process by which we discover them.
So how did you shift your attention to Genghis Khan?
Oh, well, this to make a short story long a bit, I at that time had a fellowship at MIT, which was a great thing that people were supposed to do as a mid-career sort of refresher and go back to their jobs. What they found out later is that people used it to a springboard to another life, which is exactly what I did. I went out and met all the dinosaur researchers in the world, and a lot of the then exciting finds, and to this day exciting finds, were being made in Mongolia. So that had been a childhood dream of mine to get to Mongolia, and I made that happen in 1988.
We've all heard about Genghis Khan, and I would think that most people who have not read about him and don't know as much about him as you do could think of only the Mongol hordes and the fact that he was a barbaric in his practices and he killed millions of people. He's a terrifying figure in world
picky,
history.
Picky.
But you don't see him that way. How do you see him?
I see him the way some scholars and more of them do today. What happened when I got to Mongolia was not just seeing dinosaurs, but everywhere I went, and I went with that same prejudice that you mentioned about Genghis as a barbarian, everywhere I went there, he was the sort of Washington, Lincoln, and God all in one. People prayed to him in the morning. There was the Genghis Khan bank, the Genghis Khan vodka, Genghis Khan beer, Genghis Khan Irish bar. So I thought, there's something else to him, obviously, than I know, and I began researching and reading. And realized that, in fact, we, as Western Europeans at least at that time, were far more barbaric than Genghis Khan. And he is responsible for so many advancements, not only for his people, he created a country, gave them a written language, but created the largest peacetime empire in the history of the world.
Wow.
With freedom of trade, freedom of religion. He had tax benefits for clerics and for educators. He had diplomatic immunity, passports, paper money, pants. All these things are innovations that he brought from East to West and gave us much of the modern world.
Well, given the fact that he ran much of the known world then, all of Eurasia at one point, I think, and he got to Moscow and the gates of Vienna, given the fact that he had such geographic influence and he did accomplish so many of the things that you're talking about, which we'll talk about more at length later on.
Sure.
Why do we only remember him as being a mass murderer and a barbarian?
Well, I hope that doesn't happen to all of us, but there's the reinvention that goes on in history, and you know, it's the winners that tell the story, and eventually the West got to be the dominant force. What's interesting is that if you look at writing from the West in his time, like Geoffrey Chaucer, who's not a bad writer, said, this is a good king, this is a great leader. And over time, we started in our ascendancy to want to portray every other race and nationality and culture as deficient.
He lived during the 12th and 13th centuries in Mongolia. Now, when he thought of Mongolia, was it all of Mongolia that exists today, which is very small in comparison to his time, and all of China as well? What was the area that he knew as Mongolia? Mongolia.
No, not at all. In fact, there was not only no Mongolia, but there were really no big groups of Mongols. Okay. Mongols were just one tribe among many in a very disorganized area of Central Asia. So the next tribe over, as large as his own, was Christian. There were a variety of other Mongol tribes of different forms that he united. And so he created out of, you know, he was an outcast of a small community, and yet he created a unification under the Mongol banner of all the people who lived in Central Asia, and then eventually that empire.
How did he do that? Because, as you say, he united all of these nomadic tribes together to make his sphere of influence enormous. How did he do it? Just was simply by through murder and warfare? Was that how he did it?
No. Quite the opposite. He did it by not killing people. What happened before this is that there was this, you know, constant warfare between tribes. They would kill each other. What he decided to do was, when he conquered people, to incorporate them into his army, his culture. And not only that, but to sort of put a representative group together that might be led by members of another tribe. And then they all had a voting decision, so that he organized things very neatly in units of 10, all the way up to thousands, of course. But within each group, the members of that group elected their leader. And so he really gave people a voice.
And in fact, I don't know whether I read this in your material or somewhere else, but didn't one of the warriors on an opposing tribe in an opposing battle shoot his horse out from under him with an arrow, and essentially he asked the defeated army, which one of you killed my horse? And the guy who came forward to say, I did it, he essentially hired him.
Yeah, and actually the converse too, which is that if guys came to him and said, you know, you're a good guy, I don't like where I am, I want to go with the winner, he would kill him because they had no loyalty to their own. So why would they be loyal to him? And at the same time, he had you know, some very talented warriors, and when they wanted to lead, he said, no, you can't understand what it's like to be an ordinary soldier. Why should you lead them? Your expectations are far too high.
There weren't many written records at the time of Genghis Khan's birth. In fact, that's not his name. He came to be called that much later on in life, and maybe after he died. But it was he who declared the adoption of a written language during his rule. So where does the source material about Genghis Khan come from?
Well, there's a fascinating book and a fascinating story about how we found that book. That's probably written 10 to 25 years after he died, called The Secret History of the Mongols. And it's a portrait of him that's not entirely favorable, which makes you think even more that it's accurate. The author mentions that Genghis was afraid of dogs and scared of his own mother, as many of us are, of our own. The author is thought perhaps to have been maybe a Chinese member of the court. A lot of the information that was in it has proved to be factually true about locations and such, and it tells us a lot about his leadership theories. That book itself was lost for centuries, and it wasn't until the 19th century that a Russian scholar in China found a translated copy of it in Chinese. It took about 100 years to get this archaic language fully translated, and so it's only in the last 60, 70 years that we know the contents of this book.
And that's so fundamentally where most of the information about the source, that is the source material then. That's where most of the information about what we know about him comes from, or have we been able to extrapolate more details from other sources over time?
Well, there were a number of travelers back and forth. In fact, we highlight in the exhibit that there were Chinese guys going to meet with the Pope and the kings of England and France at the same time as Marco Polo was going the other way. But there are a couple of Islamic historians whose books confirm things that are said in the secret history and offer a similar portrait of Genghis Khan.
We're talking to Don Lessem, who is the curator and creator of Genghis Khan, Bring the Legend to Life, the exhibit in residence at Discovery Place. He's also a dinosaur expert, and we'll hear more about that, too. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Don Lessem, who's the curator and creator of Genghis Khan, Bring the Legend to Life, the exhibit at Discovery Place through April 30th, former reporter for the Boston Globe and a well-known dinosaur expert. He's written, 50 books about dinosaurs, many of them for children, actually, which we'll talk about. Ultimately, this guy, Genghis Khan, who came from very humble beginnings and was exiled by his own people at some point, put together the largest contiguous land empire the world has ever known. Four times the size of the Roman Empire, four times the size of the area influenced by Alexander the Great. There was no communication back then. It was travel was arduous and slow and difficult. How was anybody able to exert that kind of influence to cobble together all this and keep it together?
Well, there was communication in those days, and there was a Pony Express that he really pioneered. And in Mongol life, there was a form of communication in massive hunting that he adapted to his warfare strategy. So when they weren't at war, the Mongols in their hunting would group together over a vast area and tie an ever-narrowing knot around animals till they finally got within sight of each other as hunters, and within that circle would be all manner of wild animals. They transferred that strategy to warfare. His army was never bigger than 100,000 men, and they had huge advantages, which I'm sure we can get to, but communication was one of them. They would travel 125 miles in a day by strapping guys on horses, changing the horses at a way station, and carrying the message further. And so that he would have two separate armies know that they could meet up at a certain point weeks ahead of time. And so, you know, surround or surprise their enemy. There's a document even about one of his descendants writing to the French king saying, "We'll meet you under a tree in this place to wage war on Islam at a certain date." And so that, you know, they could predict and follow through on bringing their army anywhere at any time. Of course, the French didn't show up, but the Mongols were tremendously organized.
Nothing's changed.
That's right.
So you said that they strapped men on horses and they could ride 150 miles in a day. I mean, that's astounding, actually. But when you say they strapped them on horses, what exactly do you mean?
Well, you know, a guy, if you have a guy riding hours and hours and hours and, you know, they can fall asleep, uh-huh. You tie him onto the horse so they don't.
I see.
And,
okay.
And the messaging system, too, was incredibly elaborate. He had spies everywhere. And one of the favored strategies that's been written about widely is that he would take a message that he needed to get, have the messenger's head shaved, write the message on the guy's head, wait a little while till the hair grew back, and that way no one could ever find the message until he got to the destination and they shaved his head again.
The exhibit that you've put together focuses on this aspect of his, part of your exhibit focuses on the aspect that we're talking about right now, this unrivaled army that he had, an unrivaled cavalry, in fact. Was he the first to put people on horses? He wasn't the first to do so, was he?
Oh, no.
No.
By no means. In fact, he's credited sometimes with stirrups, and that was used centuries before. But he used horses in a way that nobody had before, and he had horses that were different than anyone else's. You know, the ancestors of modern horses actually come from this region, and the Mongolian pony is a little animal. I mean, my feet would drag on the ground when I rode one. They're incredibly maneuverable. They're also able to provision themselves. They'll sweep away the snow and eat the grass in the winter. That means he could be so maneuverable with his army that they didn't have to have a supply train at all. These horses are extremely nimble. So you imagine the Russian army on the ice, you know, these Teutonic knights like in Alexander Nevsky movie. Genghis Khan and his army would put felt pads on their horses so that they could grip the ground, ride around on the ice, ride literally circles around the knights who would fall into the ice as well. And this kind of maneuverability allowed them to, along with the sort of intercontinental ballistic missile that they possessed when no one else did, and that is the Mongolian bow, which is a recurved bow that could fire twice as far as a European bow. So you could ride on these horses, stay out of range completely, and often they would win battles without losing a man.
Mm. They also had a catapult, which they called something else, but it was movable, obviously, and they would use the catapult to what? Throw stones and other objects, fiery objects into the enemy. And also I read they would throw squirrels, big squirrels. Why?
I can only think of Rocky and Bullwinkle. You
that's
know,
right.
Put the little hat on the guy.
Hey, Rocky.
Actually, it's marmots.
Okay.
And marmots are you know, a mountain animal. You see them in Switzerland, but they're also kind of gophery creatures in Mongolia. I've been told that they're good eating, too. You can get marmot on a stick in Mongolia. But they also are often carriers of disease. And the Mongols seem to know that they were carriers of the bubonic plague, which Mongols themselves seem to have been resistant to. Hmm. So you take a squirrel, I presume he's already dead, but you catapult him over a wall, he lands in the water supply, and over time everyone dies.
How do you explain this incredible ingenuity?
Well, it's the gift of knowing not just to be able to innovate, but to take the innovations from every culture. So the Chinese, created a lot of this engineering. You know, Genghis was among the first to use gunpowder, which came from China, to make cannons. The Europeans had trebuchets and onagers, these kind of launching devices. And he would take the best of every technology and implement it. He had Italian bookkeepers because the Italians knew double-entry bookkeeping and nobody else did.
Despite this violent and brutal reputation that he has, he, as you say, he turns out to be rather enlightened. He created a meritocracy. He rewarded loyalty. He instituted, as you mentioned, fair taxation, a stable government, appreciation for the arts, religious freedom. He opened trade. How was he, why was he so progressive?
No one really knows the answer to this. It's I think, one of the great mysteries, because he, you know, very much could be argued that he's the most influential man of the millennium. And why did he have this unique perspective? There's some great writing on this by a guy named Jack Weatherford, who's a sociologist from McAllister University. And in fact, he has several books about Genghis. The first one, which is one that really stimulated my interest, as well as seeing it in Mongolia, Genghis Khan and the Making of the Modern World. He now has the new book, Jack Weatherford, about the fact that in the 18th century, books about Genghis Khan's innovations were quite popular in America, and that there's some suggestion that Jefferson and other founders of our country adapted some of Genghis's ideas for nation building into our Constitution.
Wow. A lot of his inventions and his practices are still in use today. He's the one who came up with the idea of passports, although they probably weren't like our passports are today. He came up with the idea of cabinet positions in government. He came up with the idea for paper money. Those are just a few of the inventions. What are some of the others?
Well, I should say that the Chinese had paper money, but he's the one who brought a lot of these things. There are various sort of complicated passport systems in other cultures, but nothing as institutionalized as what he did. And in fact, Marco Polo carried one. Kublai, Genghis's grandson, empowered Marco with a gold passport that said, "If you defy me, you die," which is the kind of passport I wish I had. Help out a lot.
Did it merely frighten people, or did it actually confer rights and privileges?
The carrier of the passport was allowed to take any provisions that he needed from any place, which was, you know, these guys are traveling around the empire. Marco Polo certainly got all around, and they needed to restock at various places, and no one is going to defy that order. There were also passports that were in two pieces where one person carried one side, the other, and the two had to be matched up in order for the message itself to be considered convincing. So we have several of those in the exhibition. I should say that exhibit is devoted to those two sides of him, the conqueror, who we know a bit about, and the civilizer, who we know nothing about.
Now, you mentioned earlier that he came up with the idea for pants.
He wasn't sitting around looking at magazines thinking, oh, this looks good on me.
How do we know that? And what were the implications of pants?
Well, if you look at the back of all labels, it says made in Mongolia. But no, they were wearing, the Mongols wore these kind of culotte kind of slit pants because riding on a horse,
right. It's
a lot more comfortable and maneuverable. We know that the warriors in our time, including the knights, wore these tunics. And yet after the presence of Genghis Khan, this changes. So there you go.
Okay. Toll booths. He's been credited with the creation of toll booths, national parks, diplomatic immunity, forks, charcoal, chopped meat. All those true? All those things are true?
Well, all those things are innovations that he brought with him.
Okay.
I wouldn't call him the inventor. He is the adapter and the transmitter of these things. Chopped meat, though, is a staple of Mongolian life. Steak tartare. Well, who is it named after? The Tartars actually weren't Mongols. They're another tribe, but it's named after him. And the Mongols, one of their other great adaptations was to be able to travel light. So people may know this already, but they would, drink the blood of their horses. They always carried extra horses. If a horse died, they ate them. They would take the meat and put it under their saddle to kind of slow cook it. And so that's the kind of food they consumed.
Some people are still eating breakfast, so let's leave that topic.
modern Mongolian cuisine, and I say that in quotes, was one of the stark revelations of my being in Mongolia.
Yes, you've been there several times. So tell me about that experience, because has it changed? My whole experience of that culture is what I've seen in documentaries on television, and it looks fairly primitive. Would he recognize it if he came back?
Well, first of all, Mike, primitive is what they would call, guys who sit around TV stations and aren't around nature, or on the radio rather than riding a horse.
Uh-huh.
So their nomadic life continues. In fact, well before Genghis Khan, to this day, the life is much the same. The songs, the oral tradition of the long song and the throat singing, the very strange kind of gargling noise, that goes way back. And it's the longest song tradition in the world. So, yes, a third of the people in Mongolia, and there aren't many people in Mongolia, a third of those people still live in that nomadic style. Mm. And it's a beautiful, amazing country. It's empty. There are fewer people per square mile than anywhere in the world. It's the most extreme weather. So it gets to 120 in the summer and minus 60 in the winter. And you better bring peanut butter unless you're fond of mutton and sheep eyeballs.
Let's not go.
But maybe you are, Mike.
No, I don't. No. I don't think so. I don't. I have no experience in that area and don't want any.
I don't.
How did this postal system work? Was it more than just a Pony Express, or did he? Because it's been referred to in some things that I've read as a postal system that he created.
Right. I don't know a lot of details about how that was done. He did have a library system as well, so that the whole point of this is trying to get access to information to everyone. Mm-hmm. As this illiterate person, he had this deep abiding faith in education as the root of progress and did everything he could to stimulate public understanding. And when you talk about traditions in Mongolia, here's this nomadic culture to this day, and yet it is one of the handful of the most literate countries in the world, well beyond the United States. Hmm. So, the value of education is part of his enduring legacy as well.
And you say he's the reason we have violins? And lemons.
Yes.
How so?
Well, not together, but the violins. If you think about it, lutes were what we played. We plucked strings.
Mm-hmm.
The Mongols, their favorite instrument is called the horse guitar by us. And this Marin Hor, it looks like a sort of a cello with a triangular bass and a horse's head. And you play it by running the bow back and forth made of horse gut.
Mm-hmm.
So that stringed music, which is beautiful, and you can hear it in the exhibit, recreates the sound of horses as well, which you can hear in their music.
That's Don Lessem. The exhibit he's referring to is Genghis Khan, Bring the Legend to Life. Don is the curator and the creator behind it. Our conversation originally aired in January, but there's still time to see the exhibit. It's in residence at Discovery Place through April 30th. We'll hear more in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAG. I'm Mike Collins. Don Lessem is our guest. Genghis Khan, Bring the Legend to Life is the name of the exhibit at Discovery Place that he curated and created. And he joins us from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia. He was here earlier, but you weren't the guy riding around town or walking around town looking like Genghis Khan, were you, when you were here? That wasn't
I
you.
Wasn't. That okay. was our Mongolian curator, okay. actually, and he bears some resemblance to the portraits of Genghis Khan, which, of course, we have no idea of knowing whether they're realistic or
well,
not.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because, as we said, he wouldn't let anybody paint his portrait or sculpt his image while he was alive, but right after he died, there were people hanging around who did know what he looked like, and I'm told that's when they began to paint and sculpt. So why don't we have an accurate picture? Why wouldn't they have remembered what he looked like?
Well, the few written mentions of him is we know that he had gray hair, gray eyes, and so that was quite dynamic in his appearance. And he was obviously a charismatic guy, and a very skilled warrior himself. There's meant to be a sympathetic story of him that as he got old, that this I think is totally fictitious, but that he would in the morning behead seven people just to get kind of warmed up. And that as he got older, he lost the ability to do this, kind of got arthritic, and his follow-through was not as good. So there were a lot of rumors about his prowess, but we really don't know at all. And the only portraits that survive of that time were done by Chinese artists, and so the Mongol rulers that they painted come out looking very Chinese.
Ah, okay.
So we don't know.
He was able to do something that neither Hitler nor Napoleon was able to do, and that was conquer Russia in winter. He also, as we said, got to the gates of Vienna, and then they all turned back because it was time that somebody died and they had to go to and vote. But is that why did the empire collapse? Because it was the largest empire the world has ever known. Why did it collapse?
Well, the thing is that there are Mongol rulers that were in fiefdoms in Central Europe and Eastern Europe until the 1930s. The Mughals in India into the centuries after Genghis, that's the word for Mongol. So the empire lasted a long time, but the sort of the apex of it actually came after his time during the time of his grandson Kublai. And one thought is that he was overzealous in his explorations and that he really, in his imperialistic kind of vigor, bankrupted the country. He, among other things, invaded Japan twice with the largest armada ever gathered and failed spectacularly both times. So, you know, it may be that their eyes grew too big.
Your exhibit points out that as we look at his life and accomplishments, some of us might want to consider that we are related to him. Geneticists estimate that 16 million men alive today are genetic descendants of Genghis Khan, which makes him one of the most prolific patriarchs in history. How did that happen? How many wives and children did he have?
It's not that complicated, Mike. I think you should know that by your age. Well, the secret to doing this, if you want to try this yourselves at home.
the home version of Genghis Khan.
The home version is get 500 concubines, five wives, and then kill off a lot of the males who might be competition, and you end up with a huge spike in a particular genetic representation at his particular time. Mm-hmm. Too great to be coincidental, and so there's an allele, a part of a chromosome, that's identified to be sort of the Genghis gene. Mm-hmm. And there's a test you can take in the safety of your home to determine whether you are related, and to my disappointment, I am not. And there's another marker, which is also to be done at home. It's called the Mongol spot. And a lot of people in Eastern Europe, in particular, Hungary and elsewhere, have a purple spot on their butts. And that seems to be a marker that comes from Mongol genes.
Interesting.
I could just see people in my mind at home.
Yes. Going into the bathroom.
It's an awful image. I want to get rid of it.
Don Lessem is our guest. He's also, if you've heard of him, you probably know him as a result of the many books that he's published about dinosaurs. Now, you're not a paleontologist, but
I play one on TV.
Yes, you've done television, and you've written all these books about dinosaurs, and you have, in fact, excavated dinosaurs, and it's kind of how you got into Genghis Khan. I mean, you were there in Mongolia to excavate a dinosaur. You also have this particular talent for speaking to children through your writing. You've written about 20 books for young readers, and you have at one point have written a regular column for Highlights, which is a child's magazine. I used to take it. Does this all stem from your own childhood fascination with dinosaurs, or simply you've realized that you're an expert and kids love dinosaurs?
Yeah, what I did was, early on I wrote a big book for adults about all these wonderful dinosaur explorations, and I realized that none of them were that interested, but the people under 10 were obsessive, and this is speaking of genes, I really think there's a dinosaur gene in there somewhere that seems to become recessive at about age 8. But this ongoing fascination with dinosaurs, and I went to look at the literature on kids' books, and I thought, there's so much exciting stuff going on right now with dinosaurs. For instance, half of all the dinosaurs ever known have been found in the last 30 years. There are two or three new kinds found every month. And yet, the children's books didn't seem to reflect any current knowledge. So I wrote kind of a screed in the New York Times Book Review about how there should be more of these children's books. And, of course, nobody was really listening. I was writing to myself. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to write these books. And so I started making dinosaur dictionaries and other things for kids that revealed a little more of the current science. And then in Highlights magazine, I got, I think, 10,000 letters over 10 years, every one of which they require you, as they should, to answer. Oh, and so I really got a good feel of what's on the minds of kids, and sometimes bizarre thoughts on the minds of kids.
Really? You've been to Mongolia many times, and I think you started going there in 1990. That's what I read. And you say that the place is full of dinosaurs. There seem to be other spots around the world that are also full of dinosaurs, while other places seem to be rather fallow ground for dinosaurs. What is that about? Why do we find them in places like Montana and Wyoming and Mongolia and not necessarily in, say, Massachusetts or, I don't know, Louisiana?
North Carolina.
There are some dinosaurs in North Carolina. We've talked about this on the program. Not many, but there have been some found.
I'm not doing politics with you, Mike. No politics.
Okay.
That is a two-part question. Yes, bada bing. Sorry about that. Two-part question. One is, did they ever live there? And, of course, dinosaurs lived only on land, and most of the world is
water.
Different parts of the world were underwater. Mm-hmm. So much of the east coast of the United States was underwater during all of dinosaur time.
Okay.
Makes it much harder to find them since they never lived there. The second part is whether they're now on the surface. And so lots of places are not suitable for finding dinosaurs. Either they're overgrown or they're not areas of deposition. In other words, stuff has to settle over these bones, keep them covered. Then the environment has to switch from what was probably a rainy environment that created this kind of stuff to a dry environment that erodes this material and brings the bones close to the surface where we can find them, because we really have no way of finding a dinosaur other than seeing it. So that's why deserts, Mongolia, mm-hmm. Montana, and these dry places turn out to be the homes of dinosaurs.
Aha. Now,
but they were everywhere. They were on the South Pole. They were everywhere.
Bones sticking out of the ground are generally how a lot of paleontologists, at least, come to decide, I'm going to dig here. And you, when you were working with the Boston Globe, were assigned this story covering dinosaur scientists. And as I understand it, you came across a photograph of a slightly blurry photo of a dinosaur bone. How did that lead to your big discovery of what has come to be called the Gigantosaurus and the beginnings of your learning about dinosaurs? How did you spot this blurry bone in a photograph when paleontologists and scientists had overlooked it?
Well, I can't say that they overlooked it. They just didn't see the public interest in it. You got to remember that a scientist has a certain system of looking for things. And the things that excite us about dinosaurs, the biggest, the strangest, the nastiest, those aren't scientific questions, but they are fascinating ones to us. So in this case, there's a paleontological convention every year that I think most of us have missed over the years. And at this conference, the Society of Vertebrate Paleontologists, scientists sort of tell what they did on their summer vacation, which is dig bones. And they give short formal reports, but the students give poster sessions, which means literally up on a poster are photographs and drawings and sketches of what they've done that summer. I was going around along these boards and saw an enormous bone in a dig. And the scientist standing in front of it was a graduate student from South America. And I said, this is, you know, diagnostic. It's characteristic of a meat eater's bone. They're kind of hollow. They have certain shapes. And this is the biggest meat eater leg bone I've ever seen. And he very matter-of-factly said, yes. And his name is Rodolfo Correa. He's become a great dinosaur scientist in Patagonia and Argentina. And I said, well, what's going on here? And he said, well, I think it's a theropod, a meat eater, about 10% bigger than T-Rex. We've only got part of it out of the ground. We have no money. And I said, well, what is it going to take? Imagining that it was hundreds of thousands. And he said, maybe $6,000. And I said, okay, I think I can find that. So we cooked up a plan by which I would fund the dig and then the preparation of the dinosaurs. It takes years to clean up a dinosaur, unfortunately, and put them back together again. You don't want to put together the original bones, but make the casts and put the armatures together. So in agreement with the governments, regional and national in Argentina, we excavated this biggest of all meat eaters and then the biggest of all plant eaters. The scale of these animals is beyond our understanding unless we're under 10 years old. That's why kids love dinosaurs and we don't, because they can see them. They can feel them. If you and I, as adults, understood dinosaurs the way they did, we would be obsessed.
Wow.
Because to understand that an animal could be as big as a building, that one of its backbones could weigh 2 tons, that it could be, you know, 3 school buses long and walk the earth, things, you know, these plant eaters in dinosaur times were 10 times as big as Tyrannosaurus rex. There is nothing like this before or since in the history of life on land. So, and they were great successes. So it's a fantastic story. So for me, the fascination as an adult was, oh my God, you know, I'm the first person or among the first people to ever see this animal that ruled the earth.
Wow.
That's a fantastic feeling.
And
to see this world too, you know, I don't really see it myself, but as scientists, they do. They can read the landscape to see, in this desert, they see the river shore and the Florida-like Everglades environment that might have been there before. It's amazing.
You, in fact, have a dinosaur named after you, a dim-witted, fat-bellied one, as you describe it.
Thanks a lot, Mike.
Well, those are your words. What did they call it?
Well, Lessumsaurus. Not a lot of imagination.
And what is a Lessumsaurus?
So Lessumsaurus, you know, you're always worried. Well, there are not a lot of us who aren't dead who have dinosaurs named after us. But the fear is that it will be invalidated because half of all the dinosaurs named turn out to be bogus.
Ah.
It's not just Brontosaurus, because when you get them, you only have a little bit of information. As it turns out, Lessumsaurus is kind of an important evolutionary dinosaur because it's the link between the earliest of these big dinosaurs called prosauropods that walked on 2 legs or 4 and the great giants, you know, the Sinclair dinosaurs on 4 legs. So Lessumsaurus was kind of an intermediary character, about 30 feet long, but yes, pinheaded and pot-bellied.
That's Don Lessum, recorded in January. His exhibit, Genghis Khan, Bring the Legend to Life, is on display at Discovery Place through April. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE.